My name is Glenn Mogelson. I'm from Los Alamos National Laboratory. My original background was in astrophysics and got my degree in astrophysics. I have been at Los Alamos National Laboratory about 10 years, and I've been involved in fusion energy research for about 15 years. So that's my area of expertise, fusion energy. To give these sessions, that is the session last week on energy resources, this one on energy and risk, and the final one on energy ethics, required going into an area, as you would, that you're not an expert in, but I'm talking about is not my expertise. And so if you have additional input, you may know more about some of the things that I'm going to be talking about than I do. What I wanted to do was give you a perspective over all of the different areas and to have your input. Okay, so again, I'm not an expert. There are a couple resources that I'd like to mention. The first one is kind of a fascinating book, and this was given to me by a pastor and his wife who have been on the earth for more than 80 years. This was written by a Russian in 1929. What's fascinating about it is that it relates how the earth is really a part of the universe as a whole, and it ties in the relationship between the sun and the earth and life, and how they're intimately related. You know, the environmental issues that have come up recently, talked a lot about that. This puts it in an almost scientific perspective. Very unusual, in that life really isn't separate from the rest of what's going on. That is, it's not separate from the organic, inorganic, all the chemistry, the relationship between how the sun affects us, how the atmosphere is a part of the earth, how the interaction between the sun and the earth gives rise to the energy, the growth that we see, including life. That is, our lives, plant life, all different forms of life, and how life then impacts the environment and the earth in a very general sense, really interesting sense that I never got in my biology courses. So this is something that I would recommend to you, and I've recommended to my daughter. I read this while I was here last week. Most of the material that I'm going to present today and most of the background for presenting these talks comes from this report, which is a fascinating report. It's the National Energy Strategy Interterm Report that the government produced. It's not a strategy. This particular report is not a strategy. And that's why it's so fun. What it is a compilation of information on each of the energy sources. So you have a compilation of information about the scientific aspects of that energy source, the economic aspects, the technology aspects, everything you can imagine, and there isn't, you can have one paragraph that says one thing and the next paragraph will say something else for different reasons, so it can contradict itself. But it's information from people like you and from people like me, through meetings that were held throughout the country and through reports that were given to the Department of Energy. So I highly recommend this. There's a lot of work going through this. It's about 400 pages. But there is a summary that I brought also, and I will leave here at Holden, which is only about 20 pages, that will give you an overview of some of the things that are talked about here. With that, why don't we begin? One of the first things I'd like to know is energy resources. How about somebody, Rudy, give me an example of an energy resource for the village.
Fossil Fuel.
Fossil fuel. Somebody else? Energy. What's an energy resource that you're using?
Stream outside.
Stream, hydropower. Okay. Another one?
You've got your forests out here.
Right. How about for your own situations? What kind of energy do you use in your homes?
Natural gas.
Natural gas? Something else? Electricity from, how is it generated? What's the power? What's the source of fuel? Do you know?
Municipal.
On the Bonneville grid, you've got all of them. On the Bonneville grid, you've got.
Okay, coal, somebody said?
Use coal and natural gas.
Natural gas?
Solid waste.
Okay, solid waste, biomass?
Nuclear.
Nuclear energy?
Solar.
Solar?
Wind.
Wind? Oil?
Oil.
Gasoline, right? Okay, how about some things like, how many of you have heard of acid rain? Okay.
Can't get by without hearing that.
How many of you have heard of the word greenhouse effect? Raise your hand. Okay. Nuclear waste. Those are some of the things that we're going to talk about today. Whole bunch of different things. Acid rain, global warming, ozone depletion, nuclear waste, ecosystem impact, and hazardous waste. And there's municipal waste also. So let me go through quickly some of the different areas. I had another view graph which I could not find on oil. Oil and natural gas are similar in a lot of ways in terms of their waste, but oil is worse. That is, the CO2 emission from oil is much higher than it is for natural gas. And we'll talk about this later. But for natural gas, one of the typical problems is installation of pipelines and then the problems that you can have with that. And its CO2 emission, in addition to that, it's where it's located, are the places where the resource exists. This is also true for oil. And so one of the things that you'll have to consider when you're wondering about whether to use these resources is, what's the impact on the continental shelf? What's the impact on the wilderness areas and the wetlands and the Arctic area? And there's this struggle. Okay, this is one of the things that you get by reading this interterm report. You have the struggle of wanting to have those natural areas, beautiful areas, to remain for your children and for future generations. And yet you have the need for energy resources. And so you're struggling with that, and you have the economic needs of the country, and all these things are coming together, and what do you do? So what I'm telling you is, these are not easy things. Coal. We have a lot of coal. Those of you that were at the meeting last week realized that the amount of coal we have compared to the amount of oil and natural gas is enormous. But there are also enormous issues to using coal. You have these emissions that occur, particulates. It turns out that coal generates, as Rudy would tell you, a lot of radioactive waste. And you ask yourself, why is that? Actually, it's very simple. Coal has a little bit of trace elements in it, uranium and other things that can be radioactive. And you have to burn a lot of it. Okay, so you burn a lot of it and you end up with a lot of radioactive waste. But that's not monitored as it is in nuclear waste, not nearly to the level. You have CO2 emission. In fact, it's the primary source of CO2 emission in our country right now. And then you have these issues associated with the mining of coal. Black lung disease, explosions, there's a lot of water damage that occurs, the solid waste used in the processing, just a whole slew of things. The other thing that surprised me is that it also competes in a lot of areas for water, another natural resource. And so you have coal, but there's a lot of risk in using coal as there is in using oil or natural gas. Nuclear power, well, you have the radioactive waste. Long-term radioactive waste. What do you do with it? Right now, each reactor has its own storage, as I understand it. People are not willing yet to locate an area, although there have been areas that have been located, for storing nuclear waste. People are very concerned about that. It's radioactive for a long period of time. In addition to that, people are very concerned about the safety of nuclear reactors after the Three Mile Island accident, after the accident in the Soviet Union. So those are issues. One of the things I brought up in my last talk is that you're going to be asked, how many of you are near a nuclear power plant?
How near do you have to be?
A couple hundred miles. Sure.
Well, we are here good. Right now.
Well, one of the things that you should be aware of is that I'm pretty sure you're going to be asked whether or not you will allow the nuclear reactor lifetime to increase from 40 years to 70. Okay, so almost doubling its lifetime. Now, that's important in the sense of increasing the time in which you're receiving energy from that particular source, but you need to look into what that means. I don't have details of that, but you need to think about that and think about whether or not that's acceptable to you and study that problem, because I'm sure you're going to be asked that probably within the next 5 years. Yeah?
Because then the way it's set up now, the actual part of the nuclear plant is going to be mothballed and will be considered nuclear waste.
I think that certainly some aspect of it, you know, some of it will be mothballed. Some of the nuclear waste will then be stored. I'll talk a little bit more about that, some of the possibilities. How about renewable energies? Well, this kind of surprised me. For people that are involved in the water habitat, one of the real issues with hydropower is the impact it has on the water life. Those of you that are aware of the effect it has on salmon, you know, the salmon problem here in Washington, you know, you're familiar with that. But there is an impact on the whole ecosystem. One of the words I had up there, ecosystem of the water life. I'm not an expert in that area, and I don't understand what all the workings are of that, but it does have an impact on it. In addition to that, one of the things that you begin to wonder about, I asked my father about this because he helped build some of the dams in the Columbia River. What is the lifetime of a dam? And I don't know what the answer to that is either, but I would imagine there is a lifetime. And then that means that you're going to have to go through the replacement process. And how do you do that? What is the waste in doing that?
Can you draw on solar power a bit? What is the huge bulk there? Bulk waste,
Solar power, solar power can be used very effectively in a passive way, I believe, in the sense that if you're in a region where there's a lot of daylight, like I am in New Mexico, you can construct your housing in such a way that it can be used very effectively. That is, you You can construct it so in the mornings when the sun comes up, it goes through a window and can heat a wall, for example, in your house. And that wall can provide the heating for water heating that you need. It can provide heating for the house for a fairly long period of time, even during the winter where I am, because we have a lot of clear days. I mean, 250, 260 days out of 365. The problem with it, in terms of electricity generation, in terms of industrial use, is that it's a weak source of energy. That is, the easiest way to imagine that is to go outside and you put out your hand, feel the warmth of the sun. Now compare that to the feeling you get when you put your hand over a stove. Okay, the intensity is much higher in gas, for example. So to circumvent that problem, it means that you need a lot of surface area to collect that energy. Okay, and so if you look at the few designs I've seen of a solar power plant that would replace, for example, an oil power plant, it's huge. It's huge because of the need to collect the energy. And so then you ask yourself the question, how long do these materials that are collecting the energy last? Are they recyclable? You have all of the issues of in that case, just waste associated with that. That's the bulk waste. And the poor efficiency is related to the fact that it's such a weak source of energy. There's a lot of work that needs to be done in solar energy. And in fact, when you read this particular report, it's not talked about very much at all. And the reason for that is that the people that were involved in this obviously felt that it was a long ways off. But it's certainly it's a potential source. It just needs a lot of work.
How do you define solar energy?
Solar power in this particular sense was defined in terms of its use in industry and its use in electricity, things of that type, rather than in the passive sense where it's very effective and should be used.
You include wind that powers?
Yes, wind is another example of that. And there are
ultimately everything is solar energy except that.
Sure.
That's the
right.
Two sources we have here.
Right. Right.
There's also the green plants that produce fuel.
Right.
Solar power indirectly too. That's
the biomass is another aspect of this, and I didn't put that in, although I should have. I did in my last talk. And I don't know, I know a few of the issues related to that. One of them is in the biomass scenario, you have methane emission, which is a pollutant to the atmosphere. And that's one of the concerns. That's also a concern with coal, if you remember, in one of the view graphs.
Greenhouse gas.
Right, that's a greenhouse gas. That's correct. Yeah.
You mentioned that efficient solar power is a long way off.
It appears to be.
To what extent is that because our society has not made a Manhattan Project for this and really put more and more people, more and more money, like a crash course in getting this thing to be efficient?
Yeah. I can't answer that. I don't know. You know, if there was some example, you know, some beginning of that seed, then I could tell you, there was to a certain extent in Carter's administration, there was a lot more money going into solar energy, but it was all heavily subsidized. And if you ask yourself, well, you know, how far did they really get? They obviously didn't get very far, because as soon as the subsidies left, so did solar power. But that wasn't very long. You know, that wasn't like fusion energy, for example, that has been. Now, we've been working on that since about 1945, and so you could very well be correct that in fact we need to do that. In fact, we need to do that in many areas, and I'll talk about that. But let me pause for the moment. One of the things, or the most important thing that I want to get across today, now that we've gone through the different sources, is that with every energy source that I can think of, and every one that I've studied, there's a risk. Okay, and there's this balancing that goes on. Right now, we're very concerned about risk. We don't want risk. A no-risk society. And that just isn't what I see. And that's not what I've seen in anything. There's a risk in fusion energy, too. And so there's this tension that you're always going to have between the needs, your energy needs, and the risks associated with those needs. Now, there's been an emphasis on nuclear energy, and that's fine, but you really need to see the overall picture, and that's why I decided to talk here. So that's the main thing I want you to bring back, that with each energy resource, there's a risk. And we don't understand the consequences of a lot of those risks yet, but there is a risk. I want to talk about energy and air quality now. And this I'm not going to go through. I just wanted to let you look at this for a minute. This gives you the amount of waste, really, that you're getting into the air as a function of utilities, transportation, all kinds of things. And if you want to look at this in detail, then I would suggest that you go to the energy strategy itself. This gives you a feeling for what we're doing from 1970 to 1987 in the area of air quality. One of the other things you have to realize is that certain kinds of waste are more damaging than others. I've forgotten what this is called, the fluorocarbon? Is that the actual terminology for it? Fluorocarbons? Yeah.
CFCs, yeah.
Yeah. They can be really damaging to the ozone layer. For example, one fluorocarbon can cause a depletion of I think it's 10,000 ozone molecules. Tremendous impact. Some have less impact, like the nitrogen oxide. On the other hand, there's more of it. It's one of the emissions from coal. And I'll talk about ozone depletion in a little bit. So this tells you the impact. This is the least impact, but there's a lot of it, a lot of CO2 emission. And this one has the most. So these are kind of units of impact. And this is just another example of that, global warming. And I'll get into that too. It's the different impact of various. We've talked about carbon dioxide coming from coal and from oil, methane from coal, and from biomass, nitrous oxides from coal, these from your refrigerators and all kinds of different appliances that you're using.
I don't understand that chart, 6,400, the numbers.
Yeah, this tells you that the impact, if you want to think about it that way, the impact on warming, that is how it increased the temperature of the Earth, is almost 6,000 times stronger than the impact of carbon dioxide. But there's probably more than 6,000 times more carbon dioxide molecules, okay, that are being emitted. And so,
I'd like to mention about the methane, the one source that you left out.
And yeah.
That is being studied right now in the Vet Department at Washington State University. And that is the ruminant animals, cows.
Oh yeah, you
amazing
mentioned that.
Amazing amount of methane that they burp. And they have the cows connected up with devices so that they can measure the amount of methane that is being emanated. Of course, there are many other ruminants that would do the same thing.
Yeah.
That is methane from biomass.
Yeah, right.
That's the whole answer. They have plants that collect the down the door and collect the methane and put it in the pipeline for gas.
Oh, yeah.
Well, this is just to give you a feeling for what countries are the primary people involved in CO2 pollution. Guess who's first?
Hey, we're number one.
And so, we're doing better. 1950, 1986. But we're still concerned about that. And a lot of these countries, as they develop, of course, are going to be using more of the energy sources and polluting more. So you can see the increases. For example, in China, that could be a huge source of carbon dioxide emission as they begin to industrialize. And I think Japan cut back. No, they've actually gotten a little bit worse too, but they're doing pretty well in controlling it. So what I'm doing here is just illustrating the fact that some countries weren't even in the picture in the past, and this problem is going to be global, if not already. It's an international problem. And there have been international meetings on reducing fluorocarbons, for example. So this is not just a U.S. situation anymore. And it goes back to the original picture that I brought to you, that this is an Earth that we're dealing with, not a United States. And this intricate interaction is all that's going on in the Earth.
On that chart, and I asked one question on our own country up there. They had, on the very top line, an overall decrease in overall and percentage of world, percentage of world total, okay.
Right.
But we're still increasing.
But we're increasing. That's a good point.
Okay,
that's
because others are increasing faster than we are.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm glad that you said that, because that's true. That's what's happening.
Yeah.
Isn't the relationship there with the population growth, too? Something
oh, like absolutely.
Mexico, I mean,
absolutely.
A fast population.
Yeah.
And that's the scary thing with this whole thing.
Yeah. One of the things that, I'll mention this now, one of the things that I want to talk about tomorrow is the interrelationship, that is energy ethics, and population growth is tied into that, as is agricultural growth and land that we have for agricultural growth. All of these things are tied together, and we can talk about that in terms of our lifestyle. What does it imply about our lifestyle in the future?
It really illustrates global nature of the problem.
That's right.
Look at a chart like that.
Right. That's correct. And it really is a global. The Earth is getting small. These are examples of the different emissions. Sulfur dioxide, sulfur oxide involved in acid rain. A lot of it comes from electric utilities and fuel combustion. Everybody know what a pie diagram is? You understand what that means? This is the percentage involved in sulfur dioxide emission, sulfur oxide emission. By electric utility, so it's about maybe 70%. Again, nitrogen oxide, electric utilities are heavily involved. Transportation, gasoline.
Now that's still an acid rain factor of nitrogen.
That's right.
Oxide.
That's right. Right. So that just gives you a feeling. And again, if you want to look at this in detail, I recommend that you go to the resource room and look at this book and find the that area. The last thing I thought is important to each one of you individually, particularly if you've done anything to your house recently. My parents, working with PUD in the Everett area, had their windows replaced so that they then generated a much more efficient home. Very little energy loss in the house now, or certainly incredibly different than it was just a few years ago. One of the things you have to keep in mind, though, that when if you do that, that a lot of the things in your house are sources of air pollution. And so, you might take a quick look at this. If you have pressed wood, for example, in your cabinet, a lot of these things, for example, if you've had any dry cleaning, you smell the clothes afterwards, the chemical smell of the clothes, all of these have impact on air pollution in your house. And so if you want to look at that later, you know, just if you're in a situation where you have a really energy-tight house, you might want to pick this up and look at it and isolate areas that you might change.
Wait a minute. Some people around that are very sensitive to formaldehyde, and that's what you find from your pressed wood.
Yeah. Well, you might have some allergy problems related to it. That's one of the things you want to keep in mind, is that you can have chemical allergies, and so that's another aspect of it, but it's just not good for you. I mean, how many of you have been here during the winter at Holden? Raise your hand. A few of you? What is the wood source? What is the wood source, do you think, here during the winter? I mean, what is... I gave it away. What is the energy source?
Wood.
Wood. Okay, that wasn't fair. What's another source of energy, do you think, during the winter?
Diesel fuel.
Yeah.
Diesel.
Those are the two primary. Well, what do you think the place looks like?
It's probably a little small
somewhere. It's smoky.
Really smoky. We have an energy problem at Holden, an energy pollution related problem. When I was here in March, the pollution, air pollution, was very high. And that, of course, affects everyone in the village. You're breathing that stuff, you can't help it. In addition to that, how many of you are aware that there are diesel tanks under the ground in the village? Anybody aware of that? How many of you have smelled diesel over here?
Yeah.
Okay. They had a couple diesel tanks removed, I think it was in May, at the cost of $17,000. Now, in one case, the tank was leaking and polluting the soil in the stream. Now, that's, you know, Holden is just an example of every city situation. It's sewage, it's oil, it's hydropower, all of the different problems that a city is trying to get through are here at Holden. And I invite you, if you're interested in understanding that a little bit further, to talk to Rudy, myself. Attend the science and technology meeting that we have towards the end of this week, and become aware of some of the issues associated with the village.
A comment here, you know, we talk about man-made pollution, because that's one thing we can probably control to some degree. But Mother Nature, think of the volcano that just popped in the Philippines, or Mount St. Helens, the amount of pollution that goes up in one bang like that is probably overwhelmed what man has done.
I don't think so.
No, not so?
No, you have to be careful, and I'll give an illustration of that.
It
might. Yeah. I don't know the answer to that, but let me get to something that's related to that. It's interesting. This is, how about our water, energy impact on water and land use? These are some examples. The Valdez accident, how many people are aware of that? Everybody? Yeah, that was splattered all over the newspapers and television and everything, right? How many of you are aware of this?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you have a mine, it closes down, there's a lot of acid in the water, a lot of pollution related to a lot of the mines that are already finished.
Good example, right?
Yep, here we are, tailings. I think most of us are aware that we have a lot of the natural resources in very sensitive areas of our environment. And these things then are a consequence of trying to develop those resources if we're not careful. This was amazing to me. Look at this. This is the public lands in the United States. isn't that incredible?
You can see what the environmentalists have done.
You can see that the population went this way, right? isn't that something? I mean, this is where our growth began, and we kind of marched across the United States, and by the time we got over here, we decided, geez, you know, maybe we should preserve some of this. That's the historical way I would look at that picture. In addition to the fact that, of course, there's a lot of beauty here. But there's a lot of beauty here, too.
Create a tax problem for them to correct their problems.
Well, let's see. The other thing that you have to realize is that a lot of the energy resources, that is the fossil fuel sources, are here. And so there's that conflict again.
It's not like that land's been set aside and not being used, though.
No, that's right. And the question is, you know, what's the tension? You know, how do you use it in such a way that you don't destroy it?
Well, you did, though, they lose their tax base. Certain states, Arizona is about 90% public they own.
So they lose their tax base, and it makes a difficult situation for them to do things they would like to do in their state with their tax money.
Now, I want to go on now to, this is an example of oil spills in different ways of looking at it. Now, all of you raised your hand. Everybody seemed to know of the Valdez accident. Okay. How many of you have changed the oil in your car? Come on. Have you changed the oil in your car?
Myself?
Yeah. Good. Okay. What did you do with your oil?
Poured it around the fence post.
Somebody else?
Driveway. You got to down the desk.
Okay. Well, I will confess
what
that I...
What did you do with it now, and what did we used to do? That's the difference.
Yeah.
Exactly. Really different.
Yeah, I will confess that I can remember taking the oil, putting it in a container, and then having the garbage truck pick it up, and out it goes to the garbage. Now you can see, though, what's the consequence of that? The consequence is that you have garbage pits that are contaminated with oil, the oil seeping down into the ground and possibly into the water table. So you're polluting your environment just in that simple act. And it turns out that pollution is the dominant pollution, not the Valdez accident. That's the real problem in our country, is that ignorance, that, it's easier to do that than to take it to the garbage dump and have it processed the way it should be processed. That's you and I that are involved in that damaging process.
And they can recycle that.
They can recycle
they
it.
They have refined oil, if you know, that's available. Same as antifreeze.
Antifreeze is another example, right? And I can remember changing the antifreeze out in the street, and the antifreeze just kind of flows down the street and into the sewage system. No, you don't want to do that. This is an example of where a lot of the acid damage has occurred in our country, mostly on the East Coast, because that's where it was developed, and that's where the coal was.
It's a more acidic coal, too.
Right.
It's a hard coal.
Now, how many of you have been on garbology? It's really a fascinating thing, because, again, you become part of the city situation. Now you see what happens in kind of a microcosm when the garbage truck comes and picks up your stuff and takes it to the garbage dump. One of the things that they teach you in garbology is to look at the bottom of your plastic containers. If you see a triangle there, that piece of plastic can be recycled. Now, I was told, but I think you should attend Cheng's lecture to get more information on this, that 1 and 2 meant that it can be recycled easily. Okay, and as you go up in numbers, it becomes more difficult. It's also an indication of what kind of materials are contained in the plastic, as I understand it. So that's a way of separating your garbage, for example, into elements that can be recycled.
I just came here from Garbo, and,
oh.
and the garbologist said that he just found out from the person who's here that's going to be doing a session that it's really just an indicator of the type of resins.
Okay.
It's not a higher use or
so it's a separation in terms of how you would go to a plant that would separate according to that particular, the materials
right.
in that particular plastic. Okay.
Right. We have a store that I shop at in Portland is set up with 1 through 6. Mm-hmm. You take your things in there and then it lists what everything is.
Okay.
Well,
that's neat to know.
It's really pretty easy to do it
right.
when you've got the place to go to.
And is it true then, one of the things that I understood from looking at this is that if it doesn't have any triangle on it at all, then the people haven't bothered to do anything about the recycling.
Well, just because the industry doesn't have to do that, they will in a few years.
Yeah.
It doesn't, old plastic jugs didn't have that on, it's only the last couple of years they've been putting it on.
Okay.
So they are still recyclable, except if you don't know what type of resin.
Right, it's very hard to do.
They don't do it generally.
Yeah.
We'll
okay.
And some of it's older packaging that hadn't been used up yet.
Okay.
We'll have 2 lectures on municipal solid waste, Tuesday and Wednesday.
Okay,
and
good.
We can get into considerably more detail on this.
Right. Yeah. Well, see, the other thing that that everyone's concerned about is the radioactive waste. And again, that's a struggle in terms of, I think, fear from the public and, you know, how do you really handle it? My understanding from what I've read is that there's a lot of radioactive waste that is being stored at the reactors right now, and we really need to get it out of the reactors and into another location, because if we don't, it means that each of the reactors are going to have to increase their storage of radioactive waste. It doesn't end. I mean, you still have it, so you have to put it someplace, and so it's at the reactors. Okay, we need to have a location for it, so we have to make a decision on this. That's one thing that you have to realize. I mean, it's there, okay? And do you want it to continue to be at each reactor, or do you want to bring it to a location where they can store it? Yes?
What's the difference between nuclear waste and radioactive?
Actually, I'm not sure. My guess is that there's a whole gamut. Nuclear waste, the fission waste, is very long-term and has to be held for, it's radioactive over 1,000 years or more. Okay. But there's probably, my guess again, is that a lot of radioactive waste isn't necessarily as long-term. You may not have to store it as long. Now, one of the things that's a guess, okay, I'm not an expert in fission energy. If anybody else can add to that, please do.
I'm going to guess it's probably high level and low level.
Well, there's that too.
Yeah.
Yeah, certainly. One of the things that I've learned being involved in research, one of the hopes that I have, is that it may be possible to take the radioactive waste from a fission plant in the future and burn it. By burning it, I mean actually use it as an energy source and reduce the radioactivity in the process of using it. Now that's a new research area that's just beginning. And so what that tells me is that one of the things that you want to do with the radioactive waste is to store it in such a way that you can retrieve it, okay, and possibly bring it back and use it and decrease the waste content.
Well,
in the future.
Better technology at some time to dispose of it.
That's right.
We're putting it in a salt mine.
Right, that's right. So keep that in mind. that it's possible that the radioactive waste can be used for energy in the future and the waste reduced as a result of that usage. But that's so new that I don't know yet what are the wastes that result from that usage. How much is the decrease? What kinds of problems are associated with that? But that's something you should be aware of. Yeah?
It seems this is an example of the scientific community getting very excited about the usages for the energy without doing the homework on the down the road implications. They really did not know what to do safely with the waste. Is that not true? Was jumping into something too fast, it seems to me.
Well, I think yes and no. I think that there are people who would argue that the waste, I have a pamphlet for you to read outside. Again, that's not my expertise. I have a pamphlet that was written more than 10 years ago, where the person who wrote the pamphlet was very angry at the American public. And if you read that, you'll see why. He felt that nuclear waste was much less of a problem than the other wastes that we're generating. Now, I don't know if I agree with that, but I'm not an expert in that area. If you read his thing, it looks like it's a minor problem, you could do it, but I'm not sure that's true. You have hazardous waste, and sometimes at Los Alamos, you can really get angry there too. If we were separated from the main complex out in what they call a TA area. About 2 years ago, I'm not quite sure why this happened, but about 2 years ago, they set aside a section of our parking lot with all these drums, a drum about this high, about this big around, full of chemical waste. That really disturbed me, and we have avenues now for approaching an administration and saying, look, I park my car there, I don't want that stuff there. I mean, there could be an accident and get chemical waste all over our parking lot, my car, everything else. And so that kind of a problem occurs in my own environment. And I was particularly sensitive to it because I had a Toyota Camry for about 2 months and a truck. This was in the same parking lot, by the way, and I had a truck that was just a little bit higher, whose brakes gave out. There's nobody in it. It rolled down a little bit of an incline and smashed into my car, caused over $1,000 damage. And they have all this chemical waste in my parking lot where a truck could come in there and smash into this stuff. So, what does it say? It says that be observant in your own community. Okay? If you see a bunch of drums, this big accumulation of waste of some kind, look into it. What's going on? What are they doing?
Did they move it?
Yes, they did move it. They have municipal solid waste. One of the things that we're doing here at Holden is we have the sewage tank cleaned out, and we took the solids and we're replanting the tailings, working with the Forest Service. Okay, and that's a process that just started this year. Yeah.
Well, this hazardous waste is no longer the problem it was like 5-10 years ago, because great progress has been made lately in the disposal of hazardous waste materials into selected sites that have been established. And you don't find this, I don't know why you were having all those drums around there, but it's in the state of Washington that would be strictly taboo.
Okay.
Great efforts being made.
Oh, that's good.
To dispose of that.
Yeah.
There was a TV program not too long ago about solar energy used on hazardous waste and neutralizing it.
That's certainly possible.
Spread
it out.
Reflectors,
mm-hmm.
curved reflectors that concentrated the energy right on a pipeline that ran right through, and they run the run the hazardous waste right through there.
Yeah.
And at the end, it was neutralized.
I think I saw some of that. In fact, they're doing some research in that area at Sandia National Laboratory, I believe is where I am familiar with it.
And they talk about that they could move this here right. particular outfit all over the country. They don't have to have it in cement. They can move this, mm-hmm. They can be a movable entity.
I think what I remember about that is that they are studying that, and that's in the experimental stage yet there. And they're looking into the possibility of doing that effectively and questions about volume, how much you can actually process. But that's another point that's really important, and that is that there is a lot of research and development that is necessary, not only in that area, but when you read through this report, you see that there's all kinds of possibilities for doing things differently, but most of them are experimental. You need to do the experiments to find out whether they'll work. One of the things that I read about to improve the situation with burning coal is to combine coal and natural gas in the burning process to reduce the emissions that you get from burning coal. But there's a lot of research and technology that is needed in all of the areas, in coal and oil and nuclear energy, fusion energy, the whole gamut needs a lot of work. And people need to be supportive of that and to look into it and decide for themselves what they think should be priorities. You need to develop some scientific confidence, confidence in competence, what I'm saying. So I hope that you will look at things now that you read. And I would prefer, from my own standpoint, that a lot of the media, unfortunately, a lot of the newspaper stuff isn't very accurate. So that's very unfortunate for our country, but that's something I have to tell you, it really is not. And you need to go deeper than that, okay?
It's really biased in that.
Well, that doesn't concern me as much as just the fact that it's inaccurate. I mean, they say things that are just not true, and it's sad.
Well, it seems like that's where the report you just referred to at the beginning, the 400-page report, they need to have a section in there that has some conclusions, because your politicians can't act unless they have some conclusions and recommendations, and that people can respond to this. In other words, it doesn't do the general public any good to have an assimilation of information unless there's a summary and conclusion and recommendation section to it. And if you're getting experts to digest this, you need to have experts to sort through.
But you don't have to have experts, okay? The things, again, I...
Fooled ignorance.
People, that's one of the reasons why I'm doing this is so that you begin to be involved, okay? You've got to rely on yourself to a certain extent. You've got to become aware of these issues yourself. I can kind of give you a broad scope, but that's a beginning. If you're next to a nuclear plant and you're concerned about extending the lifetime, you've got to look at that. You can't expect the experts as such to do all of that for you.
But they've got to do more than they have done.
Well, that's true.
take nuclear plants. They had so many designs going in, and they shut everything down for 15 years, and this is probably a very valuable power source. You have all these designs. There's got to be someone that says, this is safe.
Who shut them down?
The public shut them down. Basically, public reaction.
Right.
But again, some responsible government agency should say, look, we're going to design a plant that is safe, and we're going to have a standard plant to keep the cost down and not keep changing it through the construction period to run the cost up 10 times.
Sure.
As it's in construction. If you had a standardized design that didn't have to be modified during construction, and in some standards of construction, and the public could accept then that, yes, this is going to be a safe plant, and they should be assured that it's a safe plant.
Right.
And it takes a governmental entity to do things.
Well, in fact, that is one of the plans. plants is to standardize the plant.
But now, this is 50 years after
Wait a minute. One of the things that you've got to remember is that there's a difference between engineering and research. 50 years ago, they didn't have the idea of a standardized plant. They couldn't have done that. There is a time period of doing the research, actually having a plant, through the experiment of having the plant, learning about its problems, developing a better plant. There's a whole process, research process, in doing that. And that's true in every area. I mean, coal, oil, the whole business goes through that same process. And that's a process that continues for a long period of time.
I accept that, but it's a very an unnecessarily slow response time to the education process that we go through when new things are developed.
That could be.
Let's continue. For instance, the Consumers Power Dow Chemical plant in Michigan, they spent about $4 billion. They had almost, let's say, 75% completed, and this project now has been scrapped. Is that political, or is that mechanical, or what's the reaction?
I don't know.
There's two or three others like that in the United States.
Yeah.
We got one out of SATS.
Hey, well, I got to go on here. I got another 3 minutes. This is just a picture of where the nuclear reactors are in the country. I thought you'd be interested in seeing that. I'll put that up there quickly.
Are you going to talk about fusion?
No.
Since your area of expertise.
I am not today. If people are interested in fusion, these are areas that have been defined as areas for nuclear waste. And again, I just show that to you. If you want to look at it in detail, you're going to have to go to the book itself and look at it. I have examples that I'm not going to show that give you an idea of what the chemical, what the volume of chemical waste and metal waste and so on, inorganic waste, what the quantity is in those areas. But I felt I need to go on to three areas that you've heard about. The greenhouse effect is the warming effect. Sunlight comes in, heats the earth, and you can't get the radiation out. And the carbon dioxide buildup prevents more and more of the radiation from getting out, so you get a hotter and hotter situation. We think. Now, one of the other things that I want to get across is that a scientist, particularly with something so complex as the greenhouse effect, is a guesser. I mean, I'm not going to give you facts that for sure that in fact that's going to cause, or that our CO2 emission is causing this greenhouse effect, that the warming that we're seeing is the result of the greenhouse effect. I don't know that. I mean, I can think of five reasons why we're getting warmer. They have nothing to do with the gas buildup, okay? That's not what our concern should be. Our concern, I think, is as simple as this. If you're in your house, that's your local environment, you're using things, you take your garbage and you keep on stuffing it in your house. Okay, just imagine this with me for the moment. You just take your garbage, you can't take it outside now, it's in your house. And just keep doing that over and over again. Well, what happens? Okay, pretty soon you have a house that is garbage.
Remember the old story about the Indian chief.
Anyway, and the thing to think about is that it's not only this part that is part of the earth, it's our atmosphere too. That's part of the house. And so if you're going to do that, eventually you have a garbage place. And that's why you do it. I mean, there's a lot of consequences that you can think about, but and some of them you already know about. The acid rain, I mean, that has happened. In fact, I believe, correct me if other people are aware of this, that I think Canada was going to sue the United States for a period of time. I don't know how that was resolved, but and you talk about that. I mean, just think of what's going to happen in the future. I mean, this is a This is our globe. One nation suing another nation because they're polluting their waters or polluting their atmosphere, you name it. That's the future if we don't get a handle on it.